music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
1, 2, 3, 4.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 0.
Never been done before. Never been done
in this
before.
Country. In this country.
D Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon as we continue our coverage on the pandemic, the coronavirus, and the impact that it's having. We want to focus on an institution that's been around for 245 years. We're talking about the post office. And joining us this afternoon is Mark Diamonstein. He is the president of the American Postal Workers Union, which represents more than 200,000 employees. And right now, they are facing a crisis. As you know, there's always been a lot of attacks on the post office. There's been attempts to privatize it, and this pandemic has opened up a door for that to possibly happen. The Postal Workers Union, they're fighting back, and joining us is Mark Diamonstein. So, Mark, welcome to the show. And I think this is a story that people have kind of talked about, but with everything that's going on, it's not one that a lot of people have really been able to focus in and get their teeth in. So why don't you bring us up to speed on some of the key issues that we really need to pay attention to and why?
Well, thanks so much for having me, David D, and greetings to all of your good listeners out there. So postal workers are facing three basic things. One is, we, like so many other essential workers in this pandemic, are essential workers. We're on the front lines. We're proud workers. We're proud to continue to help bind the country together and serve the people. But obviously, the conditions have been tough. And so that's a health and safety crisis that has affected us. We've risen to the occasion. And I think the people of the country greatly appreciate what the postal workers have done, whether it's medicines, medical information, vital packages, pension checks, stimulus checks, and all the things that we use the post office for day in and day out, but in normal times kind of take for granted. So that's one. But two, and it's a little ironic that the very pandemic that has us on the front lines with great appreciation from the people is also causing an economic crisis for the post office itself. Obviously, it's an economic crisis for the 99% for the workers of the world, but it's causing also an economic crisis in the post office. And here's why. The Postal Service does not receive taxpayer dollars to run. And many, many people still don't realize that.
Wait a second. Are you serious?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Yep. For the last number of decades, the post office has to run off the revenue of postage, postal products, postal services. And that revenue, it's worked. Even with new challenges and different things going on, that revenue has been enough for the post office to carry out what we call our universal service obligation, meaning by law, by regulation, and this is the way we want it to be, and it should be. We go to every address, 6, sometimes 7 days a week, 160 million addresses, no matter who we are or where we live. So it's a great small d democratic right. It's part of what we call the public commons and the public good. And by the way, that's all done with uniform and reasonable rates. So if you stick a letter from the West Coast back to me in Washington, D.C., or back to your family that's still in New York, or wherever it's going, it's the same 55 cents. But what's happening now is the pandemic has caused a precipitous drop in mail. And look, what restaurant's sending coupons into our homes? What retailer's sending their advertising? Even grandpa like me couldn't get to the store because we're shuttered in place. Couldn't get to the store to get the four-year-old granddaughter birthday card and then put it in the mail back in April. So while packages are up some because people are using internet shopping more while they're shuttered at home, shuttered in place, it doesn't make up for the lost mail volume, and therefore revenue is falling. And it's falling to the point that without true relief, the post office could literally run out of money, depending on what happens, but could literally run out of money late summer, early fall, late fall. And of course, that would then enable those who want to destroy the post office. And you hit the nail right on the head. They're those who want to privatize, meaning sell it off to private corporations. Those are Wall Street forces. Those are private companies. So if it were to be privatized, a few people would be enriched and the rest of us would lose a right, because whether we get mail, how often, under what conditions, would depend on whether somebody can make a quick dollar. Now the Postal Service is public. It's set up as a service on a break-even basis, and that's the way it should continue.
There's
a huge crisis. But go on. I'm sorry, dude.
You said a lot. We're talking with Mark Diamonstein, president of the Postal Workers Union. A couple of things come to mind immediately. One, in many places around the U.S., there is official government business that we use the post office for. Census would be one.
Absolutely.
The other one, obviously, is voting, which is now coming to the crosshairs.
That's right.
And it can be a little jarring or uncomfortable. Not that anybody is immune to corruption and wrongdoing, but if you're the head of Wall Street and we are doing vote by mail and there's a referendum to smash on Wall Street, well, maybe my ballot just doesn't get to its designated location. Maybe we don't receive the ballots at all. It would become a conflict of interest, is what I'm looking at. That becomes of concern, especially now that we're hearing that we may have to go and do a lot of vote by mail if this pandemic goes all the way into the fall up to the election. Do you think that is a incentive to kind of starve you all out and not bail you out at all?
Well, for those who don't want people to have access to the ballot box and those who believe in voter suppression, it's a motivation to starve out the post office, because the post office is the most trusted government agency. If people vote by mail, and by the way, vote by mail is not new. Military folks overseas have been voting by mail for generations. 5 states vote by mail by law at all, up and down the ballot. Your great state of California, bigger than most countries on earth, has no fault absentee ballot. 50% of you vote by mail. It works. There's a paper trail. It is secure. So we've been advocates of vote by mail as a counter to many voter suppression measures for a long time. For instance, just the fact that Election Day is on a work day disenfranchises working people. Closing down of polling stations, not having enough voting machines, are classic forms of voter suppression in minority communities, working class communities, and poor communities, and so on and so forth. So vote by mail solves not all of, but some of the voter suppression tactics. So now here we are in the pandemic. Poll workers aren't going to be able to be at the polls. People are still going to be shuttered in place. Even if we're past that, those who have pre-existing conditions may not feel comfortable going out in public as in the same way in the past. So vote by mail is really upon us. And, you know, crisis, even tragedy, and this is a tragedy, crisis brings opportunity. One opportunity is that we can expand our democratic rights and that access to the ballot box. And so we, those, it's a reason for Congress to step up and give the post office the relief that it needs so that we can get through this COVID pandemic. But there are many reasons. The post office is such a civic entity. Its mission is to bind the country together. What better way to bind the country together than having better access to the ballot box? That's not a question of who's coming to vote for who or for what, but access to that hard-fought with blood, sweat, and tears right to vote. Same with the census, as important as that is.
Right.
So much of that is also done through the mail. So if the post office is not allowed to survive, and those who cynically and shamefully want to use this crisis to move in and do away with this national treasure, you know, the people will pay a heavy, heavy price on many, many fronts.
Mark, let me ask you a couple of questions. Mark Diamondstein, American Postal Workers Union, is with us. First, I want to go back to what you started off by saying and kind of underscore that and get an understanding, a state of your workers. Postal workers are essential workers, basically. I see our postal person out here every day. In fact, the people in the neighborhood put up a sign thanking her for her work. You know, she comes in, and who knows what you go through. How have your workers been doing? Are there a number of people that have been impacted health-wise by the coronavirus, and have they had resources to deal with it? What's the state of that?
Well, that's a very good question. We obviously, like the rest of society, have taken our blows. We've had 61 postal workers have died from COVID-19.
Wow.
Thousands.
Wait, 61?
61.
So I want people to just, not to cut you, a lot of times when we talk about death, we use the numbers. But I want people to just think about that, because 61 people should not have had to die from this disease. That is somebody who delivers our mail. In many communities, you almost have a relationship with that person.
That's right.
Because you see them day in and day out. And so those are somebody with families. Those are somebody who are trying to fight the good fight. And those are somebody who didn't shelter in but came out and did that essential work. And I hope that those families and those people who passed are uplifted, and they're not just numbers and statistics. So that's something to reflect on a little bit.
That's right. Well said. And we've had thousands that have tested positive or presumptive positive. We've had over 10,000 that have been quarantined under one situation or another. But having said that, I think the second part of your question is, have we been able to deal with it? And we've been able to, because postal workers have a union and have a voice, the union was able to get involved with the post office very early. As early as January, we were starting conversation about how to deal with this. We were able to put a lot of things in place. While not perfect, it's still a dangerous world out there, has made it much safer than it otherwise would have been, and that other workers may not have had the same opportunities, other frontline workers. So, for instance, if someone was to go to the post office, you would probably see now plexiglass or plastic curtains between that window clerk who's selling you the stamps or the money order or whatever business you're taking care of, and the customer. In the lobbies, there's 6-foot markings. We have a lot of PPE, the personal protective equipment. You'll see a lot of postal workers out there delivering your mail, or in the retail stations with masks with gloves. So we've done as well as we can, and with all the challenges, proud postal workers out there. You know, there's the old saying: to rain, snow, sleet, and ice. Unfortunately, it's also true with fires and floods and hurricanes and tornadoes, and now pandemics. And I'm in awe, as a union representative of postal workers, of just how dedicated. Once again, just a deep reminder how dedicated and proud postal workers are in service to the people. And you can see that as customers and the public every day. And it's greatly appreciated.
No doubt, no doubt. So with that being said, thousands have tested positive, 61 have passed, many people are challenged. How is it that during the two or three stimulus packages that went out, we saw money go to UPS? I like them. We see them. It's going to FedEx. Nice company. But how much did the post office get? And are they fighting to make sure that you all get it on this new incarnation of a stimulus package? Is Nancy Pelosi and all those folks looking out for you? I'm still flabbergasted that the first two didn't really hit you all. So let's talk a little bit about that.
Well, I'm glad you asked the question, because that's, we got the economic impact. Now we got the political environment that should have dealt with it. In the $2.2 trillion care package, trillion. I made a mistake the other day in an interview and said billion, because you get zeros mixed up sometimes. Right. $2.2 trillion, $500 billion. Went to private corporations. A lot of it was just pure grants. The Postal Board of Governors, whose Republican majority, did ask for real financial relief. Not more debt, not more loans, real financial relief. The House of Representatives had $25 billion. It's a lot of money, but not compared to $2.2 trillion. And don't forget, it's not money going to shareholders or to rich CEOs, or in to profit margins. It's money going to the people of this country to protect their service. So we're all the shareholders in that sense. And the Senate, interestingly, which is, as we all know, is Republican control, had in their package $13 or $14 billion for the post office. Okay. So one would logically think, if the House has $25 billion, the Senate has $13 or $14 billion, that they would have reached a compromise of $20 billion, which would have been a real help. And it's COVID-related relief. We're not talking about anything else. Let's make up for the loss of revenue from COVID until we can get through this. We'll deal with other challenges down the road and other opportunities as well, because there's a lot of things the post office can be doing to serve the people of this country in even an ever deeper way. So what happened? Mr. Secretary Treasurer Mnuchin, from Wall Street himself, Goldman Sachs, told Congress, it will not be an incentive package if the post office is in it, other than loaning, allowing the post office to borrow more money from the Treasury. Well, that doesn't help the post office. It creates more debt. The post office is not set up to make money. It's set up to serve the people on a break-even basis. And what happened was, unfortunately, and I understand your reaction of why not, is our friends in Congress did not flip the script. And we have supporters on both sides of the aisle, but they did not go back to Mnuchin and this administration and say, well, guess what? You won't have an incentive package unless the people of this country are taken care of with protecting and strengthening their United States Postal Service. And then in the next big package, they called it 3.5, nothing again. The new package working its way through the House, I think they're going to vote later tonight, has $25 billion relief for the United States Postal Service. And we need all of your listeners to call your congresspeople, whoever they are, particularly the senators, but all of them, and say how important it is that you believe that the Postal Service should get COVID relief, and that it shouldn't have strings attached, it shouldn't be loans, it should be relief. And people have to feel that heat, because words are only words, but it's the deeds that matter. And the people of this country can't just take the words of how committed people are in Congress to the post office. They need to see action. So I have always believed, Davey D, that those in power got more money. They're more connected. Wall Street's very powerful. This administration is powerful, and they have an agenda. They're using this crisis to try to get the post office. They put it in writing. Your listeners don't have to listen to Mark Dimenstein. They put it in writing in June 2018. They want to sell off the post office. But I've always believed that people power is more powerful if it unites, if we're organized and we fight back. The people of this country love and respect the post office. The last Pew poll had the post office always rates the highest of any government agency. This year, it was the highest ever. We think it's an extra appreciation for what people see during this pandemic on the part of their postal workers and the Postal Service. 91% favorable. And interestingly and encouragingly, it was equal amongst those who identified as Republicans and those who identified as Democrats. So for the people of the country, this is a nonpartisan, apolitical issue. And we should not allow, and I don't think we will allow in the long run, the people we elect to Congress to turn this into some kind of partisan football or to carry out an agenda other than to make sure that the post office survives and thrives going forward.
Last couple of questions before we let you go, Mark. One, the post office has always had a strong union. Is part of the incentive, in addition to privatizing, but even as a caveat in terms of continuing the attacks, is it to weaken the union? And to, if they can weaken a postal union, that's a pretty strong union, you can, you know, move right along and steamroll a lot of others. Is that one sort of situation that we're looking at, is that union that you all have? And the second is, what would you ask our listeners to do? I think you said to call and everything, but are there other marching orders that you would ask our listeners to take on to help push back on some of these challenges?
In terms of the first question, is the union question part of the hostility to those who want to sell off and privatize the post office? The answer is yes. And again, you don't have to listen to Mark Dimenstein. The president had a second task force report on the Postal Service that was published in December 2018. And one of their proposals was to do away with our collective bargaining rights, the right to negotiate over wages and benefits with the agency. So that clearly is an anti-union view and goal of theirs. So I think the answer is yes. We also, the Washington Post did an expose of some of the strings that Mr. Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, wants to attach to this loan, which was absurd. As I said, the post office doesn't need debt, they need relief. And in that expose, they also reported that one of the goals of Mnuchin was to limit, to increase the non-career, the non-union workforce and decrease the unionized workforce within the post office. And of course, when that happens, the workers do worse, our families and communities do worse, but a few people run to the bank with the extra money that they extract from the lower wages and benefits. So the answer is yes. In terms of the listeners, and by the way, one other thing, here we have, I'm even shocked. I just read today, I think there's now 33 million people who have become unemployed from this COVID in the United States.
Yeah.
Imagine what it is the world over. Almost overnight. Postal Service has 600,000 plus decent living wage, mostly union jobs, where no matter who we are, almost 40% of our workforce is made up of people of color, is an equal number in many of our crafts of men and women, equal pay for equal work. All that means to us as workers, all that means to our families and our communities. And they're talking about undermining and destroying this entity at a time like this. So that's just an extra ingredient. In terms of what the listeners can do, Davey D, we need for everybody to call their senators in particular, their congresspeople in general. You can write them, you can email them, you can call them. We have, if people want to go to APWU, Those are for our four initials, APWU.org. We have an easy way to contact the senators through there. We have petitions on there. There's another great website, kind of says it all, U.S. Mail, not for sale.org. Okay. U.S. Mail, not for sale. And on there, there are petitions. There's over a million people that have signed these basic petitions. And we also, if you feel it in the heart, you got a good experience with the post office and what it's meant to you, a short letter to the editor. Anytime speaking up, talking to your family, your neighbors, your friends. And we also have had around the country as in support of our work, in support of the public post office, and in support of other essential workers at the time. Things like the car caravan. So I can't tell you in this show today when it might be happening in the particular areas, but if you right. hear about a car caravan, you know, it's a strange time, right? We can't gather.
Right.
I'm in Washington, D.C. I'm not young anymore. I can't tell you how many rallies and demonstrations I've been through in Washington, D.C. Can't do it anymore. So we're right. finding creative ways to try to let the voice of the people be heard. So if you hear of any of the car caravans around saving the post office, and some of them may be focused on some of the senators in their offices, please plug in. But I don't have any specifics there. But okay. we really need people to call Congress. And we think the best way that people can appreciate what postal workers are doing out here is to help make sure that we get the relief we need so that we can continue to serve the people of the country. So those letters, those emails, and those calls are really critical.
Mark Demenstein, we appreciate you taking time out. Again, we encourage people to go to the website, usmailnotforsale.org, or the American Postal Workers Union, APWU.org, and look you all up and put their shoulder to the grind and help support an institution that's been around for 240 some odd years. So thank you for taking time out this afternoon. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Dadaman. Chris Juwan Cam. Yeah. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else you just imitation. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio. Let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah. Feel me here. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy though. Oakland stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on. Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost or the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat to the belly from the steel gray beef. Say please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with their great bread making a speech. Say some peace to their lovers, our neighbor to please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. Let's go.
Real Talk Radio.
You are now rocking with the best in the West.
West Coast. Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
West Coast.
Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Over the past week, we lost a number of musical legends. We lost Andre Harrell, who was an architect for hip-hop and the, you know, hip-hop soul that they like to dub. That was prominent in the 1990s. We also lost Little Richard, who Questlove from the Roots said, don't call him a pioneer, don't call him an architect, call him the king, the blueprint of rock and roll. And then, of course, we lost Betty Wright. And Betty Wright is a well-known, influential, transformative singer. We know her for her records like The Cleanup Woman, but she's much deeper than that. Joining us on the phone line to talk to us about their legacies, or at least the legacies of Little Richard and Betty Wright, is our own Ricky Vincent, who does the history of funk. So Ricky, man, how you doing, man? We've been losing a lot of people this year in the middle of the pandemic. Seems like every week somebody legendary has been going out.
It keeps coming, and you know, I'm tired of turning my show into the obituary of funk, and not just the history of funk. But, you know, it's also an opportunity for us to kind of take another look at the legacies that all of our current music is built upon. And for some reason, we don't tell these stories enough. And we have a few outlets, you know, about, you know, shows like Unsung, and, you know about some of the specials and tributes that people put together. But, you know, this, especially this black music, it's a form of knowledge of self. It's a form of history that connects us to something ancient, really, and current at the same time. So, you know, it is what it is. It's a tough spring, and you know that means we have to go down deep into the work of Bill Withers. That means we have to recognize Prince yet again, because we lost him and we're still in shock from how much talent and vision you know left us at you know at, you know such a difficult time. So and then here we are again with, like you said, Andre Harrell, with Little Richard, with Betty Wright. You know, you're just kind of getting knocked around like a pinball, and trying to sort of get centered. But one thing you can do, and we have, this is the one opportunity that we have with all the technology, is you can do an exploration of these people, look into their works, look into the groups and the chats and the links that people post about some of these people's, in, you know, incredible moments that you know that are available, that can be found if you look. And so, if you know what you're looking for, you can find an incredible legacy of music.
Yeah, I think you're right that there's Ricky Vincent from the History of Funk. I know you're gearing up to do a big thing, and one of your legendary treats of Betty Wright. What do we need to know about her? What makes her such a iconic, transformative figure coming out of Florida, coming out of the church like so many, but she goes above and beyond. We know her for the cleanup woman, but there's a lot of people that were really hurt when they heard that she passed because she meant so much more.
Yeah, when you realize that Chaka Khan saw her as an idol, Then you have to double back and say, well, now that I think about it, you know, who would there be that would Chaka Khan would bow down to in the first place? So that says something right there. But Betty Wright is incredible because her longevity covers the entire range of our music from the 60s till now. And most of the artists that have, you know, sort of emerged in sort of these sort of iconic eras, they show up and that's it. And they're only identified as somebody from the 60s, or they're only identified as somebody from the 80s. Right. Betty Wright actually had some singles when she was like 14 years old, talking about the girls can't do what the guys can do. And then 1971, Clean Up Woman, she gets that sassy, hard stuff going, that hard soul that, you know, that's funk, but you can call it the hard soul, that's cool.
Right.
And, you know, the more you think about it, you listen to some of her stuff, The Babysitter, and It's Hard to Stop, you're like, wait a minute, she's kind of in Johnny Taylor territory, doing some of that, you know, real rowdy late night infidelity songs that are, you know, those are hot for a minute. And Betty Wright, it seemed to fit her, but it didn't make her. It fit her style because she had enough of that attitude. Betty's different because she didn't try to, you know, kick people over the head with it.
She comes out of Florida.
I was gonna say, she's a part of soul music.
She comes out of Florida, and Florida has a legacy of funk and soul that sometimes gets overlooked, and others, you know, pick up on it. But there's a lot of people that come out of that tradition. Is there something, was there just a regional thing that influenced the direction in which those artists coming from that area went? Or was she picking up her cues from other people, you know, in other places?
I think Betty Wright was a fully formed artist by the time, definitely by 1971, when she was doing Cleanup Woman and the kind of raw soul. And she was in a whole community of Florida artists, like you mentioned. I mean, she was in a studio with the band and Casey and the Sunshine Band. And
was
those
she
guys
really?
Were chart toppers.
No way. I didn't know that.
All those folks were in there together doing it. She's on one or two of their songs. Because, you know, you had Lattimore, you had a Little Beaver, you had all these, you had Timmy Thomas, Why Can't We Live Together. She was instrumental in helping George McCrae and Gwen McCrae kind of move into that smooth soul, which became the early disco thing. And she was on top of all of these kind of formations of black music. And this gets into an issue that Florida doesn't get credit. It's like, we're in the Bay Area. We know, you and I know, the Bay Area doesn't get enough credit for its influence nationally in black music. And Florida is a similar thing. And so Betty was a part of all of these artists' development, all of the transformative works. Peter Brown's Do You Want to Get Funky With Me? She was a part of that. Just about everything coming out of Florida, she could glue those things together. She arranged songs. She did some of those tricky vocal parts on some of those pop hits that not everybody could do. So she was the, you know, when she showed up, and people talked about it, she had a presence as a young artist that, you know, so this is a person that you want to pay attention to, because she knew how to make music. She knew how to put music together and put talents together and get the most out of people. She did all this stuff with Joss Stone. She started working with other, you know, contemporary artists in the 21st century that you know, saw her as a role model. But she wasn't just somebody that walked past you and said, "I'm a star here, you know, kiss my rings." It was, she would sit next to you and talk to you and work with you and get the most out of, you know, who you are and what you're doing. And you can hear that in a lot of people's music, especially folks that, you know, had the opportunity to be touched by Betty Wright.
Real talk. Ricky, I know you got to go. So the last question, and I know people can check you out on Friday to do your, you know, really in-depth breakdown of Betty Wright. But
yeah, second hour on Friday night, it's going to be the deep dive into Betty.
What are the two or three things that you want people to either check her out about in terms of music, or something that you really feel that our audience should further explore when it comes to Betty Wright?
Betty Wright is kind of the bookends to the musical legacy that you and I talk the most about, Davey. She's there at the beginning of 70s soul, and she's really there at the zenith of neo soul, if you will. So she's at both ends, and she's always there. And it's interesting because people are sort of now recognizing her, because she didn't step out and try to claim a throne of some kind. You know, she didn't say, "I'm the queen, bow down to me." She was that soul sister that you know, that you trust, that you believe in, that you, you know, are proud that, you know, she's that sister at the corner that, you know, someone you can rely on, that type of thing. And so she was, it's interesting, and it's, that's why it's tough on a lot of artists that are like, dang, she was always there. And in a way, she was always there for me, either as an inspiration in an abstract or as a personal thing. She was always there. And so Betty Wright is consistent with who she was and what she did. And you can find that in every form of her music. And like I said, her album with the Roots is really worth checking out, and an album of her early, you know, kind of salty soul is really worth checking out. But everything in between, she stands above it, even if she doesn't get the spotlight that the other women that have come and gone and are long gone, you know, would get. Betty's been there the whole time.
Ricky Vincent, we appreciate you taking time out. Of course, Ricky Vincent, the author of the book, The History of Funk on the One, is the name of the book. You know, it's
Funk, the music, the people, and the rhythm of the one.
Thank you, Funk, because, you know, I just know you always is the history of funk. So, Ricky, we appreciate you taking time out. We will check you out on Friday night doing your thing with the Betty Wright. And thank you for sharing with us and dropping this knowledge.
Okay, David D, thanks for doing what you have been doing, man. We need you so bad.
Well, we're all in it together. We're going to take a break on Hard Knock Radio. We'll be right back.
Trials we've been through, I'd never have the courage to come back to you. We're all entitled to make a mistake. We got to prepare for some heartbreak. I was earning my man while I was learning my man. Something you young girls might not understand. No pain,
no pain,
no pain,
no pain,
no gain,
no gain,
no. No pain,
no pain,
no pain,
no pain,
no gain,
no gain.
To me, my days left here may not be long. I wouldn't waste my time telling you nothing wrong. But love is a flower that needs the sun and the rain. A little bit of pleasure's worth a whole lot of pain. If you learn this secret, how to forgive, a longer and a better life you'll live. No pain,
no pain,
no pain,
no pain,
no gain,
no gain,
mm-hmm. No pain. Anything worth having at all is worth working for and waiting for. Some of my closest friends have thought they had their thing on a string just because their man was bringing them flowers and candy and all kinds of gifts. Mm-mm, honey, some gifts are just to make him feel better while he's on his guilt trip about the night before. You know what I mean? Especially when you know you haven't been doing the things you should do. Think about it. What is the man trying to tell you? Sometimes flowers mean maybe we should just be friends. Do you get my drift? Hang if you can hang. No pain, no gain.
She picked up Hard Knock Radio. East, west, north, south, conectados. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous. Speaking to the thugs, one love. We know where y'all at. Round Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415s bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from these hard knocks, slipping in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard stop. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks, listening to hard knocks, questioning the poor guy. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop, listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard stop.
This is Mook. Apu, Chama. So we don't see much because we're locked up 23 hours and 15 minutes every day. That is to say, everybody in prison all across the state of Pennsylvania are under this emergency decree of, it was March 13th or 15th. Ever since then, we've been locked down 23 hours. 15 minutes. So you're out of the cell 45 minutes a day. It can be morning, afternoon, or night. But in that 45 minutes, you gotta bathe, you can call a friend or family, you can get on the kiosk, you can clean your cell. Other than that, you're locked in your cell. It's like the whole state is a hole. H-O-L-E now. And so, that's how it was on death row. That's how it was in the hole. Well, it's like that all around now in the name of health. We've heard that people have been sick, mostly in Phoenix, which is near Philadelphia. But there have been other outbreaks, but there isn't a lot of coverage of that. The counties seem to have been getting it the worst. Of course, they're closest to the community. You know, people are coming in and going out. And I'm speaking of staff members, volunteers, visitors, you name it. But what happens in the counties makes its way to the state. It's just a matter of time. I think mass incarceration has become, I hate to say it, but I believe it, normalized. That is to say, for all intents and purposes, who gives a damn? And you know, while your family or your loved ones might care, the so-called average American, even the average American who is himself locked down in his home or her home, they find this intolerable. They find it outrageous. They're going nuts. But, you know, Pennsylvania, New York, under the crazy Rockefeller drug laws, all across the country, you got millions of people who are locked down, you know, for years in Pennsylvania and for decades, like Maroon Schultz and other people who've been locked down for decades in solitary confinement. And so, you know, people are getting a taste of this, even though it's a relaxed, distant taste. It's a taste because you can't go out when you want to go out. Can't leave. You're locked in. And it's safer, to be frank. And, you know, what we've seen is people kind of burst loose. And I hope I miss my guess. I hope I'm wrong. But I have a sneaking suspicion that we're going to see a second wave in this country. And the fact that it's already the country with the highest number of COVID-19 related deaths tells me we're going to see some really grim days and some really high numbers. The numbers are jumping. It must be 2,000 a day, 1,300 to 2,500 a day, and those numbers are rising. in the last few weeks, they've gone from hundreds to tens of thousands.
You know, how does it feel to you about the fact that even though a virus doesn't discriminate, we've seen that it now does discriminate?
Well, because it follows the economic realities of the system in which it operates. That is to say, the people who are in touch with the public, the bus drivers, the nurses, many of the doctors, police, fire, a lot of them, especially in the big cities, are Black and Puerto Rican. And they're out there, you know, to feed their families, support their families, and they're in contact. And many of them have very little protection. They're being treated like, essentially, they call them essential workers, but they're being treated essentially like all workers.
They're like,
you know,
they're like,
go to work and shut up.
They're like disposable workers.
They are. So if you really are honest about it, to call them essential workers is a lie. It's like calling a prison a correctional institution. You know, and I know they don't do much correcting here. All they do is harass people and make them worse. Essential workers are really disposable workers. They're the people, and you know, as the news has caught up with that reality, and we've gotten the reporting of, say, 60% of the people who are dying in New York are Black and Latino, you've seen other parts of the state, the United States, whiter parts of the state, saying, come on, unlock us, we're not those guys. And we're seeing that. So they're really disposable to the economic and political system.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Hard Knock, turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program, turn in for the real talk. Don't stop, EMN, at it again. Sandman, Daddy Man, Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation, stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, you just imitate. Simulation, step into the zone, the Bay Area zone. Hard Knock, radio, let's go. Big shout out to Davey D. Feel me here. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though.
Yeah.
Oakland, stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah.
Bellevue. Come on, check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats, trying to eat till they're ready from the steel gray beats. They bleed. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great red man. Lovers I made with a breeze. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. You go, hey, but it ain't David D.
Real Talk Radio. You and I rocking with the best in the West.
Yes, Coast.
Monday through Friday.
Sing it, Chris.
Let's go.
Thank you.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of What's the Tea Virtual Edition, every Monday from 7 to 9 p.m. live streaming on Zoom.